Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Gary Heseltine. Gary Heseltine is a veteran UFO researcher. He's the editor of UFO Truth Magazine, and he also has the police database for UFO sightings, which is the first of its kind, as far as I know. He's also one of the top researchers in the UK. He's very familiar with the Rendlesham Forest case. So without any further ado, Gary Heseltine, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you for having me on the show, James.
You're welcome. Gary has a background with the Royal Air Force as well as being a detective constable after he got out of the military service. So Gary brings to the table investigative techniques and investigative discipline, which is ideally suited for his role as a UFO researcher. For the benefit of our listeners, Gary, can you tell us a bit about how you came to be a UFO researcher and your voyage of discovery that brought you up to this point?
It's actually a very circuitous route. But basically, I had a childhood sighting when I was the age of 16. That kicked off my interest. But that interest remained personal. I didn't really tell anybody about it, other than girlfriends, that kind of thing. And then between 1983 and 1989, I served in the Royal Air Force Police for 6 years as an RAF policeman. And for 3 of my 6 years, I worked on two nuclear bases guarding tactical nuclear weapons for aircraft at RAF Honington in Suffolk and RAF Larbrook in what was then West Germany. So that, in a sense, makes me, from a British point of view, uniquely qualified to know exactly what was going on with the Rendlesham Forest case, but we'll come to that later. And then I left the Air Force in 1989 and joined the British Transport Police and worked until 2013 when I retired early. In 2002, whilst I was still a serving police detective, I created what's called the Pruforce Police Database. Pruforce standing for Police Reporting UFO Sightings. It's aimed solely at British police officers' UFO accounts, serving and retired. And it's a combination of archive material and of archive material in the sense of newspaper reports mentioning police officers who had been involved in UFO events, books similarly, and also from police officers who had contacted me personally as a result of creating the database. So more cases were added. I started that database with 6 cases that were historical from books that I knew about, involving 10 police officers. And now, 15 years later, I've over 550 cases involving nearly 1,100 British police officers. It was unique, still is unique as far as I'm aware. There are one or two minor police websites. There's an Australian guy who does a has got a lot of police cases featured from all around the world, but it's not his own research, as it were. He's just highlighting cases. So I think it's pretty unique in the world. It could be replicated anywhere in the world. But aside from that, one of the unexpected things that I never anticipated when I launched the database was the UFO groups, of which I didn't really know that many existed initially throughout the UK, picked up on it and said, "Would you do us a lecture about some of the police cases?" And lecturing is not something I'd ever done, but when I did it, I actually found my personality came very easy to stand in front of a crowd. Most people will run a mile, but for me, it never fazed me at all. So I guess I was lucky. And so I started to do lectures initially in the all around the UK, and then from 2010 onwards, when I was given the Disclosure Award by Steve Bassett in Washington, D.C., I've been doing international lectures every year since then, as well as UK-based ones. So that was obviously very good for me, because the Disclosure Award was effectively the PRG World Disclosure Award. So it opened me up to a much bigger audience worldwide. And as a result of that, inadvertently, it also created the foundations for the magazine that I do now. Because over those few years, when I began to meet all the top international UFO researchers, I then got on with them very well, and they were obviously very interested in the work that I was doing. And so when I decided to retire early in 2013, I did so because I'd had the idea to create a 96-page bi-monthly, every 2 months, e-zine, it's not in print, trying to create the strongest English language UFO, solely devoted to UFO magazine in an e-zine form, because it's designed to be read on platforms like tablets and smartphones, so it's scalable, etc. And it obviously there's minimal overheads, etc. And so I went back to many of these people that I've met, these top researchers, and said, would you write either a regular column for the magazine, or I appreciate you've got your own research, would you do occasional columns for the magazine? And they all said yes. Basically that's what began in 2013. And here we are into its fifth year, celebrating be 5 years in April, and we're up to issue 29. So, you know, it goes from strength to strength, and I would argue that it has by far the strongest lineup of top and renowned researchers anywhere in the world of ufology. And even going back to the days of old and printed magazines, you know, the number of quality people that write for the magazine, the list is pretty endless. So that's the idea, is to create the world's strongest English language e-zine in an easy format that people can just store on their tablet or on the phone and collect.
That's a great idea. It's kind of a modern version of the old Flying Saucer Review that was so popular for many years and was the standard of its time.
Over Absolutely. It was a great magazine, and I've got all the archive on that. Sadly, it's no longer around. And many, you know, but even many of the best magazines had a lot of not well-known researchers or international researchers. They had a lot of basic British researchers, say, for Flying Saucer Review, with occasional columns from foreign correspondents. But it was a lot harder then. So in a sense, they were great, great magazines. And you know, to make a comparison like that is not me doing it. But, you know, my mentor was a guy called Graham Birdsall, who for 20 years was the top person in the UK magazine-wise. And he had a printed magazine called UFO Magazine. And I got to know him over the last 2 years of his life, because he lived very close to where I work. So I was able to call in and see him. I was a detective, so I would go in and have a cup of tea and get to know him. And basically, he encouraged me and gave me that opportunity with my first ever article in a magazine, which was about the police database. He wanted me to carry on what I would, the idea I'd set in place, i.e. the police database. And he was the one that gave me the opportunity in January 2002 with that article. Sadly, he died only 2 years later in 2003 of a brain hemorrhage. So that was a real tragedy. And at the time, I said when I went to his funeral that it had put British ufology back 10 to 15 years. And I think it had. But kind of ironic, really, that he retired he died in 2003, and yet it was then another 10 years before I was able to feel financially secure enough to take the risk of retiring early. I'd done 24 years, and 10 years later in 2013, I tried to pick up the mantle, as it were, with the magazine, and a lot of the people who read it, make very complimentary comparisons with that magazine. I wish, in a way, UFO Truth magazine was in print. But when I initially tried to look into the print side in 2013, I was quoted 50,000 to 100,000 pounds to get it on the high street shelf. It was a specialist publication, and by the way, you'd have to put your house as collateral, and there's no guarantee it would work. And that was just too big a risk. So hence why it came out as an e-zine. But in a strange kind of way, the timing was right for an e-zine, because most magazines now have gone that way purely to save money, because the print costs are so expensive. So I think whilst it is lovely to have a physical piece of paper, a book, magazine, I think, like, if you look at the way it's gone with books, there are more e-books than there are printed books now. So it's just the way it's gone. But yes, I still have my collection of printed magazines, and they are lovely, and I cherish them, kind of thing.
Over the years, what are some of the police on-duty and off-duty reports? There must have been so many, but which ones stick out in your mind? And is there any given region of the UK which stands out in your mind as a true UFO hotspot?
Having worked in the police and seen, at one point early on in my career, I worked in a kind of what was then a new format of instead of police officers putting in their own crimes on the computer, it was then centralized region by region into a kind of like a crime database, and civilians would be inputting all the crimes to take that away from the police officers so they could stay out. So it was very early on in the early 90s, and I had like 18 months doing that, and I kind of saw that the police, and I'm sure it just wasn't the British Transport Police, but any police force and anyone doing statistics can make a statistic out of anything and kind of put a slant on it however they want. You can play the statistics figures. So my basic reservation is I basically don't like statistics because they can be manipulated, so they don't mean that much. However, from time to time, I have done some basic statistics for the cases on the police database, and there are a couple of things that do stand out. At this moment in time, we're probably running at, of those 550 cases, and it's an approximate because I don't update it all the time like I used to because of the work on the magazine, so it kind of goes on the back burner a lot of the time now. But of those 550 cases involving those 1,100 police officers, 70% of those cases, approximately 69-70%, are multiple police officer witness cases. So that's two or more, which is quite an impressive statistic when skeptics try to say, oh, it's just a lonely police officer at night, tired, and he's made a mistake with his eyes, kind of thing. So, you know, you've got cases going from two all the way up to 24 in one case from multiple different physical geographical locations. So cases like that of six or more are quite common. What else? In terms of regions, the answer to that was that in Britain, the biggest region in England, we call it counties, geographical area, and of the like 43 counties in England, Wales, I think it's something around those numbers, England, Scotland and Wales, the biggest one collectively was Yorkshire. Yorkshire is one of the largest geographical counties, and it's so big it has been divided into three: West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire and North Yorkshire, each having their own respective police force, by the way. But if you put those three together, Yorkshire would be the biggest one. And there was certainly a big link-up of sightings between Yorkshire and its neighbour on one side, which on the west side is Lancashire, kind of War of the Roses thing, Lancashire, Yorkshire.
Yes.
Especially near that border in the 70s and 80s, there were many, many sightings. So I think different areas can have, like in ufology generally, flaps when there is a sudden spurt in a specific area or a certain specific country. Like, you know, you can say France in the early 50s, Mexico in the late 80s, etc., that when there's suddenly a dramatic increase in the number of sightings. Belgium between 89 and 91, they had a big spurt of triangle sightings. You know, we would refer to those as flaps. So I think that you get little spurts in all counties, but I haven't updated the county distribution for three or four, well, probably not since I created the database, not since I created UFO Truth magazine in 2013, because that obviously is now my priority. But yes, they're two statistics that for me are interesting. The most important one for me is the number of multiple police witness cases, because I think that just stands out as knocking the skeptics, making it far harder for the skeptics to deal with.
Of course, when you mention Yorkshire, I think of the famous case of, I think his name was Tony Dodd, the late great UFO researcher. He had, as a police constable, an encounter with a landed craft there in Skipton, if memory serves. So,
Well, quite close. He was a sergeant, so he wasn't a PC. He was a sergeant, and he was, at the time he had his first major sighting, he was on duty, and he was with a fellow police officer, a constable called Alan Dale, and the sighting took place near Skipton in North Yorkshire, in a little place called Conninly, near to Conninly, and they saw, it didn't land, but they saw a very structured circular UFO that appeared to have windows, about 50 feet circular, and it went right, it hovered right above their police car at an altitude of only about 50 feet. So 50 feet, if you look up, is pretty close and not something that you could easily mistake. That kicked off his interest, and he then began to devote his own private research to it. And then when he retired from the North Yorkshire Police, he then became an active researcher for the old UFO magazine, the printed magazine run by Graham Birdsall, which was called Quest Publications originally, or printed by Quest Publications under that banner. And he became one of their top researchers. And when he died, it was just not long after I'd created the database. And he was somebody I'd obviously read about and respected his work. He wrote a book called The Alien Investigator, which is a very good book. Which I've got a copy. When I created the database, I rang him a couple of times, and I was hoping to meet him, because my job would occasionally take me into North Yorkshire. And basically, I rang him up one day when I was actually not that far, maybe 4 or 5 miles away from where he lived, which was in Grassington, near Skipton, and was hoping to call in for a cup of tea and make his acquaintance. But at the time, both he and his wife were retired and really starting to suffer ill health. And it just wasn't convenient at the time. But I told him what I was doing, and he said, it's a great idea. You know, good luck with everything. And then I did try one more time, and unfortunately his wife wasn't very well at that time. So again, it was just one of those things, and then he sadly, his wife died, and then he died quite quickly afterwards. So it was a real shame that I didn't physically get to meet him, but at least I talked to him on the phone, and he kind of gave me his blessing, which was nice.
Over the years, a lot of times when people share information, they want to do it off the record, especially if they still have a sensitive position, like a police constable, a police sergeant, whatever the case may be, or an active duty or recently retired military person. over the years, has any policeman or ex-policeman confided in you more than just the sighting, but perhaps maybe they were taken on board a missing time experience, an encounter, if you will?
Well, what I offer and what I created when I began the database was the ability to make people a confidential source, because nobody knew better than me, having been a police officer and still a serving police officer when I created it, how difficult it was for many serving police officers in particular to come forward, because they would risk their careers or perceive a risk to their careers, and the main thing was potentially suffer a lot of ridicule. So what I created was I treated them like the police do with people who give anonymous information, as it were. I created them as confidential sources, similar to, I guess, to the press. But if you think about the police will always have informants, and there's two ways you can do it. If you're a paid informant, they go on a national register and they get given a pseudonym and they have a handler and a co-handler, and nobody else knows their real identity apart from a very, very few select people to protect them for obvious reasons. I didn't quite take it to that far, but one of the lesser qualities is if somebody is a member of the public and they want to give information on an occasional basis and they don't do it for money or anything like that, they could be regarded as what's called a confidential source. And again, they're details are protected. So I did that. So when police officers approached me, if they were still serving, and it still applies now, and they said, look, I can't go public, but do you want my story? And I'd say, yes, I can make you a confidential source, providing you supply me with all the information I need to convince me that you are who you say they are. Because obviously, anybody could ring me up and say, well, I'm a sergeant this, and blah, blah, blah. But they could be just a compelling liar. So what I would say is, right, you've got to show me details of your police career. I would ask them a few police-related questions, which only a police officer would know to ask. Talking to another police officer, they would give the answer. There were various other little things that I would do to check people out. I'd ask them to send me photographs of themselves in uniform, or if they were a detective in plain clothes with senior officers in uniform, those kind of things. And that's how you get round that. As to your question with regards to, have anybody said that they've been on a craft? No, in terms of police officers, what I have had, some police officers who probably had been abducted, but they chose not to go down that route. I mean, I would offer and say, it sounds to me like you have classic missing time. You obviously have some memory block there. Do you want me to try to organize some kind of regression? And I would give them opportunities. On the two occasions I can think of with officers, different officers, they chose not to, which is their personal choice. But if you were asking me, looking in at what they were telling me, then they showed all the classic signs of having some missing time and having memory block in certain areas. So that's the closest to it. Now, what I do in those circumstances, or with anybody who contacts me, is that goes down the possibility of having had an abduction. Whilst I know a hell of a lot about abduction, I don't regard myself as an abduction researcher stroke expert. But I know someone who is. And so I refer those cases to a friend of mine called Dave Hodrian, who runs the Birmingham UFO group, BUFOG, as its name. And he's does a great job. He has investigated in the last 8 years, 9 years, something like 200 or 300 abduction cases. And he has all the relevant contacts and experience of dealing with these people one-to-one. So with somebody that I suspect is, and they want further investigation down that line of regression, etc., I put them on to Dave Hodrick. And then he comes back to me either with a concluded story or a confidential source account. And that's the way we deal with abductions. For a long time, when I created the date, well, initially when I created the database in 2002, on what I'd read and having no personal experience at that time of abduction, I was, you know, I knew about the Barney and Betty Hill case from 1961, the Travis Walton case, 75, but I didn't really have any first-hand experience, as it were, and I was initially quite wary of the abduction accounts because it is often an area where, and my cynical police detective head would say that literally people can make up a story of people where they can claim to have been abducted, show no evidence whatsoever, can confabulate an abduction account based on many others, and could literally make it up. And I was kind of wary of the subject. But that was dispelled early on in about 2013 when I began to research Britain's first recognised abduction case, which is the famous police sighting by Alan Godfrey. And so when I got to know Alan and researched his case for about 18 months, I at the end of that process, I realised that abduction was very real, and that in many, many ways, they needed to be validated. Yes, perhaps 10% are made up and offer no evidence and just want, these are people who are probably have some psychological issues and want to belong. But 90% of people who claim to have been abducted, in my experience, both police officers and civilian-wise, are absolutely genuine, and they just want answers, and they are genuinely nice people. Nothing special about them. They're just ordinary people who get caught up in fantastical events. So that kind of made me change my perspective on abduction, and therefore I was a lot more comfortable after dealing with Alan Godfrey, because his case is just, you know, arguably Britain's first proper abduction case or recognised abduction case. And it was such a fascinating case, it opened my eyes.
And if memory serves, was Alan Godfrey with law enforcement as well?
Yeah, he was a police officer. That's in a sense. But one of the things that we haven't talked about is I'm not religious in any way. I respect people that are, but I'm not religious in any way. And the idea of fate or synchronicity, in fact, synchronicity was a word I'd never, ever heard of until I got into the UFO research field. But I would have to say that in my life, and that's all I can go on, there have been so many strange coincidences that have got me to where I am now that I kind of do think there is in some way that I'm being compelled to do what I do. Other people are compelled to do what they do, but I feel compelled to go down the route that I've taken. And that's kind of weird because I'm not religious in any way. And it kind of, it smacks of a kind of divine hand, which is a massive thing to take into account because I'm not religious. But, you know, I do think things happen for a reason. And the reason why I say that is because when I think of Alan Godfrey, I was aware of Alan's case because it had been mentioned in UFO magazine, it had been mentioned in books. It was a very famous case. But here's the coincidence. He lived less than 40 miles away from where I was living at the time. Now, when I created the database, I obviously thought, this man lives so close, how lucky for me that I'll go see him. And we got on really well. We still do. He's actually speaking at my conference, at one of my conferences later this year. And so if he'd have lived 300, 400 miles away, I probably wouldn't have made the effort to see him in such a way. But with him living so close, it meant it was right on my doorstep almost. And similarly, when I talked earlier about Graham Birdsall, who sadly died in 2003, he lived less than 20 miles away from where I lived. Now, again, he could have lived 400 miles away and it would have been that much harder, but I was able to see him. He was actually on my patch. I worked out of Leeds. He worked in Leeds or just outside. So it was kind of like ridiculously silly how all these people were on my doorstep as if they were giving me a sign, come and see me.
I'd gotten Alan Godfrey and Tony Dodd's cases mixed up in my head because I was thinking of Alan Godfrey when I talked about the landed craft and I was thinking of the abduction encounter. So thank you.
Right. I see what you've done there.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying. Both of them outstanding researchers.
Oh, by the way. Yeah, now, and Alan Godfrey has just released only in late 2017. He's finally written a book about his events and how it affected his life, which was in the main not very good, because just as an aside, a bit of information, when he went public in a roundabout way, what used to happen is that there were in 20, 30 years ago in England and in Britain, most little towns had a police station with a small number of police officers patrolling that area. Whereas now they're big, huge, centralized police stations with hundreds of police officers. But it wasn't like that. Every town had a little police station. And that was the case when Alan had his event. What used to happen is that the local newspaper would ring up on a Friday morning and say, have you had any good cases overnight? You know, that kind of thing. They'd ring the front desk. Have you got any juicy burglaries for us? So they could do a little story in the local paper. Well, that's how Alan Godfrey's story came out. The local reporter rang up and said, have you got anything overnight? And the guy on the desk just laughed and said, well, not unless you include bloody flying saucers or something like that. And the guy says, what happened? So he tells, and because it was a close-knit community, the local reporter knew of Alan Godfrey. So he went to see him at his home. And Alan, at that time, had no real knowledge of UFOs or anything like that. And he was just a gruff, well, you'd say Yorkshireman, but he's actually born in Lancashire originally, but would say a gruff Yorkshireman, and no nonsense. And basically said, oh, yeah, okay, then this happened. And Alan, at that time, didn't fully appreciate what had happened to him, hadn't appreciated that he'd had some missing time. And so he gave this story that went out in the local paper. And at first he got a bit of ribbing from his colleagues, but it kind of like disappeared. It was just in the local paper. But then as things happened over a course of a few months, he went on to have some other experiences that culminated in a national newspaper headline. And because he'd gone on to have 4 hypnotic regressions, 3 of which had been video recorded, and this alien abduction scenario comes out, the classic missing time, being taken aboard a craft of some kind, being laid on a bed, having small creatures putting machinery on his legs as he's laid down. He sees a humanoid figure, there's telepathic communication, kind of all classic abduction stuff. But at the time in Britain, people were just laughing at the abduction scenario, really, apart from those who knew a bit more. And so when he came out, it was a big thing in the newspapers. But what happened to him that wasn't great is that the police force he worked for, West Yorkshire Police, turned on him, didn't like the attention one of their officers was having, and they basically treated him very poorly for the next few years. In fact, until he had to retire on ill health several years later. So I think he retired after... I think he retired on ill health in, he was injured in 77, so from 1987. So 7-8 years afterwards, he got a lot of hassle. And there was some quite underhand things done, like he was on the guise of a yearly medical, which all police officers had. He was picked up by a colleague and told to report to this certain hospital. Well, it turned out this certain hospital is a big psychiatric hospital, and he went into this room thinking he's just going to have a normal police medical, as it were, and there was a panel of three psychiatrists, and actually his colleague, who went, he was a bit nervous, and so Alan asked his friend to stay at the back of the room, like for a bit of moral support, and he went in there, and then actually his colleague at the back of the room was so incensed that he realized that they were doing a psychiatric evaluation on Alan because of what he'd said about his experience. And so he stood up his friend and said, "You think he's a nut, and this is a psych evaluation. No, he's not, this isn't normal." And he dragged him out of it and said, "You're not staying." And when it turned out, when the police officer questioned them, they thought that he was off with psychiatric problems, they'd been given the wrong information, and they were shocked because was their referral, that they thought he was off with psychiatric problems, and he wasn't. He was just off on Hill Health, and so they were shocked. So there was a lot of underhand things done to try to pressure him to resign. And whatever, he was asked to sign the Official Secrets Act twice. Normally you sign them when you join the police. Well, he was also asked to sign them again and not to talk about his UFO event. It's like they didn't want that association in the media with being a serving police officer. But the cat was out of the bag. But he did have a lot of hassle. It affected his family. His children were teased in the press because he was ridiculed in the press. And it drove him to the brink of suicide. I think Alan would be the first to admit that. At one time, he contemplated that because he couldn't cope with being ridiculed in the way he was, and that kind of is very sad, because that is something that's been created purely by the debunking era from 1953 onwards, and a lot of people just don't realise that. Anybody since 1953, born after 1953, has lived in an era of debunking, which was specifically created with the Robertson panel, which was CIA commissioned in 1953, put a team of scientists together, and their set aim was, how do we strip the aura of flying saucers in the minds of the public? And they concluded the way to do that was to work with the media, in all its forms, film, radio, TV, books, etc., magazines, to start debunking people. And unfortunately, that was heavily pushed by America. Britain follows America's lead on almost everything. And it's become the all-pervading theme and for the last 70 years. And so you literally, have that era that began specifically. And it's worked because, the classic reason now why people don't go public is fear of ridicule and a perceived risk to their career. So it's very powerful, and it's about time it stopped, because I think the people can handle the truth.
It reminds me of what happened to some American law enforcement members, like Herbert Shermer, 1968, taken on board a craft in Nebraska. And then afterwards, he starts receiving harassment and undergoes surveillance monitoring, etc.
Absolutely. There are classic cases. I think there's even been in America one case where a police officer committed suicide.
Yes.
So it's not an easy thing for police officers or any professional people. And over the years, since I went public in 2002, I've spoken with newspapermen who've had reports, but they could never go public. I've spoken with architects who've got their own prestigious business who could never go public. And by the same token, I've spoken with people who run childminding agencies who wouldn't go public because they'd lose all their children that go to their, because they get labelled as nuts and they'd lose their business. So there are many, many good reasons why people don't come forward and ask for anonymity. And as long as they can prove their case to me, who they say they are, then generally I will give them that confidential database status. for the simple reason is that that's the only way you're going to get a story. And for me, it's the story that counts.
In the recent past in America, there have been mass sightings involving one or more police jurisdictions. I think of, what was it, Stevensville, Texas. There was Illinois in the recent past. And are you aware of similar cases in the UK where there would be a multiple jurisdictional sighting involving law enforcement, but then you have like the military, perhaps intelligence overlay, where pretty soon the nature of the story starts to change? You know, we go from having candid on-the-spot interviews with the cops who are talking about what they've seen and eyewitnesses, and then suddenly, you know, the debunkers and the disinfo types show up, and then some pressure is applied behind the scenes to law enforcement to tamp the whole thing down. I mean, the intelligence overlay begins to kick in. Have you seen that aspect of it in the UK?
Yes, but it works in a more subtle way than in the States. What historically happens in the UK is that the police officer or the media would, a newspaper would pick up on a report that something was happening, and then you'd quickly get some quick response to, have you got any comment, and there'll be something said. And then what happens, certainly in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, is you'd have, or from the 50s onwards, you'd have either somebody from the Ministry of Defence or somebody from the Royal Air Force go to the police commanders and ask to see the officers, and they would then say, you're not to say anything about this again. Well, often the case, by that stage, the press had got wind of it, and then there'd be this clampdown, we've nothing to say. And often what used to happen in the UK is that the local police superintendent, one of the senior people who had run, you know, responsible for X hundreds of men kind of thing, they would call a press conference after the police officers themselves had often given statements, and say, no, it was Venus. It was kind of not the swamp gas, but it was meteorological. It was just a mistake, and play it all down. So I think in Britain, it was far more subtle. But let me quote one case of how the secrecy worked. A former police officer called Trevor Blower, who approached me with a case, I think it was in 1969. And he was a police officer in uniform on the beat, as it were. And he was, I can't remember which force he belonged to, but it was in a rural area. And he was out on, I think, on mobile patrol in a rural area on his own. And he got a radio message saying, just keep an eye out for something in the sky. We've got word that there might be something odd flying in the sky. So anyway, he's looking up at the sky. And then a couple of minutes later, he sees 9 spheres. In an arrowhead formation, like the red arrows, as it were, the flying formation, or the falcons flying, you know, when they fly in tight formation, in an arrowhead formation, and these 9 spheres go past. There's no wings, there's no plane, there's no tails, there's no engines, there's no noise, and they're holding close formation, and they fly past in this arrowhead formation totally silently. And he can hear on the radio that other police officers geographically nearby are reporting, yeah, I can see them too, kind of thing. Anyway, well, the way it works there is that he is then called the next day to his headquarters, his local headquarters for the police. And there he finds himself one of 6 police officers. All 6 were in different geographical locations, all saw the same thing. And they were told to have an interview with somebody who was in plain clothes. Obviously, I suspect he's probably Ministry of Defence, who individually spoke to them at length and then said at the end of each interview, you are never to talk about this again. So it was a bit more subtle, you know, those kind of events. But there are many, many cases like that, you know. And I still say now, like, last year at the magazine holds 2 conferences per year in the UK, one a 1-day event and one a 2-day event. Well, at the 2-day event last year, there were 2 police officers on different days who approached me during the break in lectures, separately, unrelated to each other, and they both said, "Can I have a word?" And they both said, "Yeah, I'm a police officer, but I can't go public with this because I'm still serving." And one of them was a firearms instructor, you know, so this, you can't get a more credible, responsible job than a firearms instructor. And he said, "If I was to go public with this, I would not be a firearms instructor again." So again, you know, that's another case for the database. But this is typical of what you're finding even now, that the two main reasons, ridicule and a perceived risk to their career, is the reason why pilots don't go on the record. Very few pilots go on the record. But what a lot of people don't realize is that over 2,000 military pilots worldwide have gone on the record. Over 3,000 commercial pilots worldwide have gone on the record. But unfortunately, the press don't point you in the best direction all the time.
Now, over the years, you must have spoken to some journalists and people in the media. Have there been stories you've heard where the British government had invoked a de-restricted notice to tamp down or squelch any discussion about a given UFO case?
There was one incident that came from a member of the press who told me that they'd worked for, I won't reveal the details, it'll be in the book, but I'm writing a book about the police cases, so I'm saving some things back. But there was one case where certainly a member of the who was a journalist, told me that a D notice had been invoked over a case. So that doesn't come as a surprise. The D notice in the UK is, and I don't know if it applies in other countries, but the D notice in the UK was where essentially the government or the armed forces could put a restriction on what a program was going to show or pull the program entirely. So that's pretty powerful. They can have that remit where basically the government say, "We don't think this is in the public interest. We don't want you to put that out." And on this occasion, it didn't. And to hear it from a member of the press who was then a junior member of the press, it was fascinating, because you kind of hear these little stories but have no first-hand knowledge. And it was good to have this validation from a junior reporter who basically said, "Yeah, I was there at the time it happened. It did happen." So that was good, and again, it's a good story for the book.
In the time we got left in the first segment, Gary, and it's been a fascinating discussion thus far, one of the trends we've seen in the last 20 years or so is we've begun to see more and more of this military connection overlay, and how certain military bases become infamous in the lore and the annals of UFO research because of the incidents, the UFO overflights, alleged UFO research done at a given base and what have you. And then the segues into the stories of underground bases, which we'll be getting into in the second half. Over the years, aside from places like Rendlesham, which we'll get into in the second half, what are the bases and regions where there are stories of this military interests, military investigations, as far as the UFO ET subject is concerned?
There's a couple of bases that have got connections. There's one what was called RAF Macrahanish in Scotland, and there were a lot of sightings around there, and it was rumoured to be, has a runway, and it's in the middle of nowhere, really, and it's the Mull of Kintyre. So it's really a long way out from the big populous towns and in that area. So it's in the middle of nowhere, and there was rumours, connections to that UFOs were regularly seen over that, although a lot of people have speculated it was where they did a lot of testing of US spy planes that would come in and do some rural flying over Scotland. But the one that comes to mind within the police environment and military was RAF Rudlow Manor, which was actually the home of the what was called the PNSS, which was the home of the RAF police, of which I served. I never served at Rudlow Manor, but supposedly under Rudlow Manor there was a vast underground complex, And over the years, I've known one or two RAF policemen who told me that there was, but they had only limited access. But then a couple of years ago, well, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, I met a guy who worked for the American forces, and he worked, he wouldn't go public with it, but he said, I work on the ground, and there is a big American contingent under RAF Rudlow Manor, which was, and there's apparently 60 odd miles of tunnels. So, and he said on one occasion he went into the wrong area because it's so vast, and he came across a bit that he'd never seen before, and there were different American security on who said, where are you going? You're not going past there, pal. And he was a security police himself. So it was an entirely different contingent blocking off a certain area that he was totally unaware of, which surprised him. So I think anything is possible.
Well, we've reached the end of a very fascinating first half with our guests. Gary, can you let our listeners know how they can contact you if they've got any information that you'd find interesting and in your sphere of interest? And also, could you give your website again?
Well, I'll make a special offer to your listeners. The magazine is a 96-page bi-monthly e-zine. It's subscription-based. You do it online via PayPal, 6 issues a year. And ordinarily, there is a set price. But what I will say to any of your listeners, that if they want a free copy, all they have to do is email me at heseltinegary@hotmail.com, and I'm sure you'll put this out in writing on your web links. Heseltinegary@hotmail.com. Say that you've listened to the James Bartley Show, and I will send you one of the 1 to 28. So you choose a number between 1 and 28, and I'll send you that relevant issue to your email so you can have a look at it for free. And it's packed with information. The website is ufotruthmagazine.co.uk, and the police database, which there are links from the website, is proofforcepolicedatabase.co.uk. Proofforce being PRUFOS, police reporting UFOs, basically, police database. So, yeah, that's how they can contact me, heseltinegary@hotmail.com. If you've got any questions, then I'm more than happy to answer them, time permitting.
Well, there you have it, folks. You have the opportunity to get a free copy if you just mentioned that you listened to Gary on the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Well, for our listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.